Okay, let's learn the Megillah. Let's start by learning the Megillah. I sat this morning and I was literally reading the Megillah in English to my Talmidim in YU. And I said to them, you know, the Mishnayos, when they talk about the mitzvah of the Megillah, it's called Kriyas HaMegillah, reading the Megillah. No one asked us to learn the Megillah. We're just supposed to read the Megillah. Okay, so let's read the Megillah and let's understand something that's totally shocking about the Megillah. Let's start from the beginning. I'm not going to do the whole thing. It begins with Ahasuerus throwing a party. And at some point along the 187 days, towards the end of 187-day party, Ahasuerus decides to invite Queen Vashti to display her beauty. Forgetting what the Gemara says, the Midrashim say, Ahasuerus sent 7 people to bring out Vashti to display her beauty. That's written explicitly in the text. And Vashti refuses. What would you say? Pashut Pshat? She's not interested in coming to some drunken party. Again, whatever the intentions were, she's not interested. And Ahasuerus takes it to heart in a very heavy way. And Ahasuerus says, I'm going to teach Vashti a lesson. He turns to his officers and he seeks their advice. And next thing you know, Vashti is being told she's never coming back before the king. You don't want to come before the king. It doesn't say that he kills her. If you just read the Megillah, it says that he sent her away, never to see the king again. And letters are sent out throughout the land that everyone should learn the lesson of Vashti. What's the lesson of Vashti? Don't mess with the king. Respect authority. Respect the law. In that society, respect the law meant that a woman can't respond that way to the demands of her husband. And therefore the letters are sent in all languages to all people that every man should be in charge in his home. In case there was any doubt, says Ahasuerus, the man of the household is supposed to dictate to his household how things are supposed to be. Ahasuerus wants to institute law in the land. Okay, that's the end of the first parak of the Megillah. Jumping ahead to the third parak. Haman comes to power. Ahasuerus commands all of the other officers to bow before Haman. Mordechai says, I'm not interested in bowing before Haman. And they're pressuring Mordechai. The other officers are saying, Mordechai, there are laws, there are rules. Didn't you read the first parak? You saw what happened to Vashti. You have to follow rules. Mordechai says, I don't follow. This is a rule I don't follow. And they pressure him, and they pressure him, and they pressure him. He's not interested. So they come to Haman, and they tell Haman, Mordechai won't bow down to you. And Haman is enraged. So Haman says, why won't he bow down to me? Pasuk says, they tell him, because he's Jewish. So Haman starts to think, Jews, wow, this Jew, so many people bow down to you. Why does this Jew not bow down to me? You know what? Maybe Jews have a problem following rules. Jews seem to have an issue with authority. He started to think about it. You know what? Jews have a lot of different rules. They think they can make up their own rules. So Haman decides it's not enough to kill Mordechai, but I'm going to go after Am Mordechai, the nation of Mordechai, the people of Mordechai. And he comes to Ahasuerus, and he presents his case. These Jews, they think they can do whatever they want, whenever they want. There's this Am, the Mifuzar, Mifura, they're all over the place, and they do their own thing, they have their own rules, then I'm just reading the Pesukim, or telling the story. Yeah. And Haman offers to pay for Klal Yisrael, and Ahasuerus says, do whatever you want, they don't listen to rules, just do what you want with them. You can take care of them, letters are dispatched, Va'ir Shushan Navocha. And the word gets out, and the people in Shushan are afraid. And the Jews are mourning, and they're donning sackcloth. As we begin the fourth parak of the Megillah. We're only going to do a couple more psukim. In the fourth parak of the Megillah, again, if you just read the text, it sounds like Esther has no idea what's going on. And she hears that Mordechai is running around right outside the king's gate in sackcloth and ashes. He's crying, he's screaming. She sends him a change of clothing, as if that was the big issue. Mordechai didn't have something clean to wear. And Mordechai sends back, through Hasach, a message. You have to know what's going on out here. Haman has an evil decree. Esther, we need you to go to the king and plead on behalf of your people. Now, bear in mind, the Megillah has already told us at least twice that Mordechai told Esther not to reveal who her people, who her peoplehood is, where she comes from, her origin. So that's a big secret until all of a sudden now Mordechai changes the story. He says, you don't have to go right away and tell Ahasuerus the Jewish people are sent to death and tell Ahasuerus you're a Jew. So Esther says to Mordechai, she sends back a message to Mordechai, and you'll take a look at the pasuk. It's parak dalet, pasuk yud aleph. Esther sends back to Mordechai, What is the most famous rule in all of the land? What is the most famous law in all the land? You look at the pasuk, it says everyone knows this law. Whether you're an officer, whether you're just a regular person from, you know, from the Am, from all the Medinot. You're just a simple person. There's one rule that is really well known. And that is, you do not come before the king without permission. I have not been summoned to the king in 30 days. And I cannot walk into that room. And Mordechai says, no, but you gotta go save your people. Esther, don't think you can save yourself. Now's your chance to do something heroic. And maybe this is the reason you're in this position of power. And Esther in the end decides to go. Now let's just think about this for half a second, okay? If we follow the steps so far, I'll make it very clear. What is Mordechai asking Esther to do? Esther, I want you to go in front of the Melech Ahasuerus without permission. Esther says, that's the most famous law in the whole land. And Mordechai says, no, I want you to go to Ahasuerus. Break the law. So I'm going to go in and I'm going to break the law. And what am I going to tell him when I break the law? When Ahasuerus says to me, excuse me, Esther, what are you doing here? Don't you know that there's a law that says that you're not allowed to come into the king without being invited? What's my response supposed to be? What's her response supposed to be according to Mordechai? I'm Jewish. My friends, did you follow what just happened? Vashti got killed because she didn't follow the law. Haman comes to power and Mordechai doesn't follow the law. Haman plots to kill all the Jews because he convinced Ahasuerus that Jews don't follow the law. Now Mordechai is saying, Esther, break the most famous law and try to explain yourself by saying what? I'm Jewish. And Ahasuerus will say, exactly, Jews don't follow the laws. Jews think they can do whatever they want. Mordechai's plan is literally the most backwards thing that Esther could possibly do. It reinforces the entire misconception that Ahasuerus has about Jewish people. It's exactly how Haman slandered Klal Yisrael to begin with. Oh, you think Mordechai is an outlier? No, Mordechai is the leader of these Jews. This is just the way Jews are. Daseim shonos mikol am. They do things differently. They never respect authority. Ahasuerus, remember, you killed Vashti and you made it known to the whole world that this is not an acceptable way in under my rule for a woman to respond to her husband. And now you have Mordechai disregarding your authority. And this is a Jewish problem. So Mordechai says, now, go Esther, go to Ahasuerus, break the most famous law of the land, and explain yourself that you're Jewish. Is there anything more backwards than that? And yet, that's the thing that actually saves Klal Yisrael. The question is, how could that possibly be? If that's the turning point, if that's a moment where all of a sudden Esther does the unthinkable, and doing the most backward, from a Hishtadlus perspective, it's the most backwards thing she could possibly do. And yet, Dafka, from the thing that made no sense, Ad Delo Yada, that's certainly a Purim theme, all of a sudden, the Yeshua comes. What's the lesson for us? HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to do irrational things. That's not what Hashem asks of us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the ability to think for a very good reason. Right? But HaKadosh Baruch Hu also wants us to know, and Purim maybe more than any other Yom Tov reveals this to us, Purim reveals to us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who's in charge. And you could sometimes do the most backwards thing, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings a Yeshua from that place. Let's learn together an insight from the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Huttner. Rav Huttner quotes a Maimer Chazal, where our sages taught that a person who does malacha on Purim will not see bracha from their work. A person who goes to work on Purim, a person who trades stocks on Purim, a person who does business on Purim, will not see blessing from their work. Okay, some people go to work on Purim, not able to take off. I personally feel that if a person could, find a way to take off to go skiing in the winter, so you could probably arrange to have a ski trip one day shorter and save a day for Purim. Okay, that's my personal feeling on the matter. So says Chazal, if a person works on Purim, you're not going to see blessing from your work. Says Rav Huttner, why is that? Why do the sages say that? So he explains as follows. Why do we ever have a right to go to work? Let's ask a global question. Why do we, if we believe in Hashem, if we believe Hashem runs the world, if we believe our parnasa comes from Hashem and all of our success comes from Hashem, what right do I ever have to work? So Rav Huttner says, the heter to work is a pasuk in Chumash. The pasuk tells us in Chumash Devarim that God says, I will bless your efforts. I will bless your work. Ah, so okay, so we found the pasuk that says you're allowed to work. So now let's think about it. So we can point to a pasuk, I think it's a parsha's Ekev. Hashem says, I'll bless your work. So now let's ask. So again, why did Hashem grant us that permission? Hashem, I ask a question on you. You wrote in the Torah that I'm allowed to work, it's reasonable to work, but Hashem, wouldn't it make more sense that I should just trust you? Why do you want me to spend time working? So Rav Hutner explains, because Hashem wants you to have a work ethic. He wants you to be a worker. Of course, some people, unfortunately, spend too much time focusing on Olam Haza work and don't spend enough time on Olam Haba work, spiritual work. But Hashem grants us permission to, so to speak, work in the real world in order to become accustomed to making effort. Because in Ruchnius, in spirituality, it takes effort. Learning Torah takes effort. Davening with Kavana takes effort. Changing your Midos takes effort. So Hashem gives us a special heter to do work, right, in the physical realm so that we can become accustomed to working, and then we can hopefully use that, and then some, in the spiritual realm. Explains Rav Hutner in such a brilliant and deep way, in the Pachad Yitzchok on Purim. Rav Hutner says, but there's one type of work that even though we do it all year round, we kind of know it's not within our hands to do. And that is destroying a malik. Because the Torah says, on the one hand, macho, timche, you should erase a malik, you should defeat a malik, you should uproot evil, and we spend all year working on it. We try to rid the world of evil. But there's also a word in the pasuk that says what? Emcha, I will erase. Hashem says, I'm going to be the one to finish this job. I'm the only one who can really erase a malik. So says Rav Hutner, all year round, when we have permission to work, right? Just like we work in the physical realm, we work in the spiritual realm, and that includes what? Working on the defeat of a malik. But on Purim, that's the day when we really defeat a malik. And on Purim, we acknowledge that who's the one who really finishes the job? Who's the only one who could really make it happen, so to speak? Emcha. Macho emcha, zecher malik. I will erase the malik, says Hashem. So therefore, says Rav Hutner, on the day that corresponds to surrendering and giving it over to Hashem, Hashem, you finish the job, we lose our heter, we lose that permission that's granted to us the rest of the year to do our hishtadlus, to do our part. You follow the logic? Let's say it again. It's a very deep idea. It's an amazing idea. All year round, I'm allowed to work in the physical realm, and that trains me to work in the spiritual realm, and included in that is trying to do my part to uproot Samalik. Well, if Hashem, if you're the only one who can actually make it happen, the only reason I was allowed to do my hishtadlus was because I believe that I can make it happen. On Purim, Hashem, I'm acknowledging that you're the only one who can make it happen. So therefore, Chazal says, so then don't go to work on Purim. Kol ha'osa malacha b'Purim, a person who engages in business on Purim is not going to see Simen Bracha. Because Purim is maybe the one day of the year where more than ever we hand it over to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We show a Kadosh Baruch Hu that we have no one to rely upon other than you. Esther did exactly that. Mordechai sent Esther to do something which from a logical perspective made no sense. It's backwards hishtadlus. And yet it worked. Because again, Purim teaches us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge. Think about Esther's personal life. It's such a sad story. The Gemara says, let's start with the Pasuk. The Pasuk says that Esther was adopted by Mordechai because she did not have a mother or a father. She was an orphan. The Gemara makes it infinitely more tragic. The Gemara in Maseches Megillah says Esther never had a mother and never had a father. How is that biologically possible, you'll ask? When Esther's mother was pregnant with her, her father passed away. And as Esther's mother was giving birth to her, Esther's mother passed away. So from the moment she was born, she never had parents, not for one second. Her mother died in childbirth. What happens when a person doesn't have parents? So there's one of two responses. A person who doesn't have parents, or God forbid, doesn't have a good relationship with one's parents, how does that impact my relationship with Avinu Shabbat Shemayim? In one of two ways. Just like my own parents don't exist, either they're not alive, God forbid, or they don't exist for me because they don't care about me, I don't have a good relationship with them. So too God doesn't exist. That's one response. I once read a book called The Faith of the Fatherless. It's about people who became very well-known atheists, and all of them, it studies their personal lives, and all of them had either came from broken homes or had lost parents, and because of that, that became their narrative, that the notion of a parent who cares about me doesn't exist for me. And they turned that into a rabid hatred and disbelief of God. That's one response. The Baal Shem Tov also lost his father. The founder of Hasidus lost his father at a young age. And his father said to him, in one of his final comments to his son, "Fear no one but HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Fear no one but Hashem." The other possibility is, God forbid, if a person doesn't have parents or doesn't have a strong relationship with parents, I find someone to replace that relationship. And who do I turn to? I turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's exactly what happened with Esther. Why does the Megillah highlight that Esther didn't have parents? Why does the Gemara make it even more tragic? She never had parents. What is a person supposed to do? Esther had no one else to rely on other than Hashem. And therefore we find Esther, again, rising to the occasion in a remarkable way and doing something which is crazy, which is impossible, which is the opposite of everything you would have expected. There is an opinion, you might laugh at this, and it's pretty hard to fit it in with the Pashup Shad of the Psukim, but there is an opinion that Esther was actually 75 years old when the Purim story took place. Now you'll say, Moshe Tzvi, read the story carefully. What do you mean? It says that they took young women. So how could Esther be 75 years old? And the story took place over, you know, a number of years. The Megillah starts in the third year, and then before you know it, it's the seventh year, then it's the 12th year. So when was she 75? I'm not sure. All I know is Rav Chaim Kanievsky quotes an opinion in one of his Svarim on Megillah's Esther that Chazal say that Esther was 75 years old. How that fits with the Pashup Shat, I'm not sure. But I can tell you this. Maybe what it means on a deeper level, again, I don't know how old she actually was. We'd have to go back in time to find out. But when I see the number 75, I think of the Midah of Esther. I think of the quality of Esther, the character of Esther. The word bitachon is gematria 75. Esther was a person who embodied what? Who embodied 75, who embodied bitachon. The ultimate balas bitachon. You see, what's the difference between amunah and bitachon? We make a mistake sometimes. Purim is a yom tov of bitachon. What's the difference between amunah and bitachon? So we'll use the definition of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish wrote a little sefer called Amunah Bitachon. It's on other topics as well. And the Chazon Ish says, Amunah is the abstract faith in God. I find, personally, when I talk to people, most Jews don't have Amunah issues. When people think they have Amunah issues, more often they have Bitachon issues. What's the difference between Amunah and Bitachon? It's a very important difference. Right? Amunah is faith. Do I believe that there is a creator to the world? Do I believe there's a God somewhere out there? Most people in the world, forget Jewish or non-Jewish, most people in the world believe in some type of higher power. Bitachon asks me to do something totally different. What does Bitachon ask me to do? Bitachon asks me to live that faith, to trust it, to do something with it. Right? So Esther, do you think that Hashem, you know, there's a God in the world? Yes, of course there's a God in the world. Great, Esther. So now go into Ahasuerus and do the most backward thing you could possibly do. Go in, violate the law, and try to explain yourself that you're Jewish, knowing that the only reason that Jews have their lives hanging in the balance is because Haman just convinced Ahasuerus that Jews don't follow the law. That is the most backward thing you could possibly do. But Bitachon demands of a person to lean in to HaKadosh Baruch Hu a little bit, to actually lean on Hashem, to rely on Hashem, to be prepared to take some type of leap of faith. The title of today's shiur was A Wholesome Leap of Faith, and it's based on the following dream that the Skolya Rebbe had. The Skolya Rebbe was a big tzaddik who survived the Holocaust, passed away in the 1970s. Skolya, S-K-O-L-Y-A, Skolya. The Skolya Rebbe, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Levracha, was really a remarkable tzaddik and really a miracle worker, said he once had a dream about the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh. Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov came to the Skolya Rebbe in a dream. This is one of my favorite images in the world. There are so many lessons in this story, in this dream. The Skolya Rebbe said, all of a sudden in his dream, he sees the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov is standing on top of a cliff, overlooking this, you know, valley down below. This huge hole in the earth. And the Skolya Rebbe is standing a couple of feet away from the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov is standing at the edge of this cliff. And the Baal Shem Tov says to the Skolya Rebbe in his dream, he says, do you want to see what it means to really be an Eved Hashem? You want to see what it means to really be an Eved Hashem? To live your faith, so to speak? Yeah, the Sfarim say that Eved Hashem is Gematria Amunah. Gematria, the word Eved Hashem is Amunah. Right? But he says, you want to see what it really means to be? Eved Hashem is not just amuna. Eved Hashem is bitachon. So says the Baal Shem, you want to see what it means to really be an Eved Hashem? The Skali Rebbe is standing there looking at the holy tzaddik, the Baal Shem Tov. Again, the Baal Shem Tov lived hundreds of years before the Skali Rebbe. Whatever his image and his dream was of the Baal Shem Tov, he saw it standing at the edge of that cliff. And he says, you want to see what it really means to be an Eved Hashem? And the Baal Shem Tov jumped off the cliff. He jumped off the cliff. Now you can imagine, the Skali Rebbe, runs to the edge of the cliff and he looks down to see what happened to the Baal Shem Tov, Rachmana Litzlan. And he looks down and he sees that the Baal Shem Tov, like a crystal vase, shattered when it hit the bottom. And it's little pieces, little slivers, little broken pieces of the Baal Shem Tov. But here's the key point. He said when he looked down, I like to tell it, I like to make it more dramatic. He ran down the cliff to the broken pieces to pick up the broken shards of the Baal Shem Tov, the shattered pieces of the Baal Shem Tov. And he looked at the pieces and he saw that each little piece, to use his words, was a tzura shlema of the Baal Shem Tov. Was the entire image. Every little broken piece was a full Baal Shem Tov. A little miniature Baal Shem Tov. It still had the whole picture, the whole tzura, the whole shape, the whole essence of the Baal Shem Tov in all of those broken pieces. New ladies, what do you say? A lot of lessons in that story. There's a lot of lessons in that story. You know what I think, in the context of what we're talking today? What was the Baal Shem Tov saying? Jump off a cliff, do something irrational for God? Hashem gave us a brain. Hashem wants us to use our das. That's what separates us from animals. It's a very holy thing, das. But Purim is the day of Ad Delo Yada. Purim is the day that we acknowledge the fact that I don't really ever know what I'm doing. Of course I try. Of course there's a mitzvah to do hishtadlus. Rav Hutner brought a pasuk to prove that. All year round we do our hishtadlus. Even when it comes to defeating a malik, that's also our job. But one day a year I have to acknowledge, you know what, I don't really have a clue how any of this works. And sometimes I have to lean into Hashem a little bit and take some risks and jump off what appears to be a cliff that's going to shatter me and destroy me. But sometimes when you hit the bottom, when I've leaned on a Kodesh Baruch, when I've taken a risk, right? All of a sudden I realize, you know what? Take me. Maybe it's Baal Shem Tov. When a Jew relies on Hashem, when a person has bitachon, not just emunah, not abstract faith, but when I take a risk, again, an appropriate risk, I'm not, God forbid, advocating anything dangerous here, but when a person takes an appropriate risk and says, you know what, Hashem, I'm gonna put it on you a little bit. Like the pasuk says, Hashlech al Hashem Yahavcha. Throw your baggage on Hashem. That's what the pasuk means. Hashlech al Hashem, throw onto Hashem Yahavcha, your burden. When I'm willing to transfer some of that control to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, when I'm able to be like Esther, who may have been a young woman but was the embodiment of the number 75, Gematria Bitachon, when I'm able to take a little bit of a step off that cliff, to remove a little bit that safety net below, and be willing to trust that what? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu will carry me? That I have the ability to take another step? That's how Yeshuas take place. That's how the miracle of Purim took place. Again, Purim is an extreme example, where Esther did the very opposite of logical, reasonable, rational hishtadlus. Mamish, the opposite end of the spectrum. But Purim highlights the extremes. Purim highlights the total removal of das, ad delo yada, as people are mekayim through the drinking of wine on Purim. It's very interesting. Kabbalistically, we know that the sviros, which are the various expressions that Kadosh Baruch Hu uses to interact, in Kabbalistic language, to interact with the world, it's divided, the 10 spheres are divided into 3 intellectual attributes of God. Chabad, Chachma, Bina, or Das, or sometimes called Keser, Chachma, and Bina, and then the 7 emotional attributes of God. Chesed, Gvura, Teferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, Malchus. The 7 weeks of Sfira. So Omer, we're working on these different midos, different character traits. The 7 spheros, the 7 lower spheros, also correspond to different body parts, and they also correspond to different holidays. So Chesed, for example, it says in the Tikkuni Zohar, corresponds to your right arm. Right? Yemincha Hashem. The right side is the side of Chesed. The left arm is Gvura. Your body, your torso, is Tiferes. And then it says in Tikkuni Zohar that your 2 legs are Netzach and Hod. It doesn't assign them specifically. It says the 2 legs are Netzach and Hod. Which one is the right leg Netzach? It's the left leg. The 2 legs are Netzach and Hod. The Yomim Tovim that correspond to Netzach and Hod are Purim and Chanukah. Are Purim and Chanukah. Right? Bring me a proof. Where do we see that Purim or Chanukah is Netzach or Hod? Usually we assume, again, they are somewhat interchangeable, but usually we assume that the right leg corresponds to Purim and corresponds to God's Midah of Netzach, and the left leg corresponds to Chanukah and Hashem's Midah of Hod. And you just start thinking a little bit and it starts coming to you naturally. Oh yeah, chu'asam ha, yisala netzach, that's Purim. Right? Netzach is Purim. Chanukah, lahodos ulahalo. Yes, hod, of course, that's Chanukah. Hodah, that's what Chanukah is all about. So usually we assume the right leg is netzach, is Purim, the left leg is hod, is Chanukah. Again, they're somewhat interchangeable. Why are our legs the Yom Tovim of Chanukah and Purim? What makes Chanukah and Purim different, let's say, than Chesed, Gvura, Teferes? Let's assign those to Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. What's different, and the simplest difference between Chanukah and Purim as opposed to Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos? Deraisa versus Derabanan. Right? Which ones come from the Torah, which ones come from the Rabbanan? Right? Chanukah and Purim are what? Are rabbinic holidays. And they're holidays that emerge dafka at very difficult times. The salvation of Purim took place as Klal Yisrael were trying to figure out, will there ever be a second temple? Will there ever be a Bayis Sheni? Chanukah took place when Bayis Sheni itself was crumbling. And the way the Svarim explained, why were we blessed with these Yom Tovim of Purim and Chanukah, in that order? To give us chizuk. To help us to take another step. To carry us through the Gullus. That's why, if you look in the Medrash says that even when Mashiach comes, Purim is forever. That's what the word Netzach means, eternal. One opinion even says Purim and Chanukah. When Mashiach comes, Pesach's not going to be such a big deal anymore. We're going to have new Yom Tovim based on the arrival of Mashiach. But Chanukah and Purim, something special about those holidays. Those holidays continue to walk with us. Purim represents legs, right? The part that carries you. The part that challenges you to move forward, to take another step. Again, the Baal Shem Tov standing on the edge of that cliff. Every one of us has that cliff. We all have whatever that thing is where if I take it, I'm going to fall. No one's going to catch me. And Hashem says, Purim and Chanukah, again, we'll focus on it from a perspective here. Right? But Chanukah and Purim are those Yom Tovim that help us to take those next steps, to continue to support ourselves, to stand ourselves up once again, and to be willing to take that courageous next step. The Pasuk says in Tehillim, listen to this Pasuk. Im amarti mata ragli, if I say that my foot has faltered, has stumbled, again, im amarti, if I say, mata ragli, that my foot has slipped, chastecha Hashem yisadeni. The chesed of Hashem helps me, supports me. One more time, for all the note takers. Im amarti mata ragli, im amarti, if I say, mata ragli, my foot has stumbled, chastecha Hashem yisadeni. The kindness of Hashem helps me, carries me. You know what's so fascinating about this pasuk? What's the im amarti, if I say? If I claim that I stumbled, says David HaMelech, no I didn't. Such an important pasuk. If I think I'm going to stumble, if I think if I jump off this cliff, it's going to be the end of me, and then I find out, you know what? We got more Baal Shem Tovs when we hit the bottom. Right? More wholesome broken pieces, broken but whole pieces of the Baal Shem Tov. Because I made myself vulnerable, because I took a risk, because I leaned on Hashem a little bit. Hashlech al Hashem Yehovcha. David Melech says, Im amarti matar agli. If I thought, if I said, this is going to be the end of me, Hashem, you proved to me over and over and over again that that's simply not true. You promised that you would take care of me. Does Hashem not promise us so many times in Tanakh that He's going to take care of us? So why don't we believe Him? Why don't we believe Him? Does Hashem lie? We might feel that Hashem lets us down sometimes. Does Hashem lie? What's the first thing God said in the Torah? I was thinking about it today. Vayomer Elokim Yehiyor. God said, let there be light. Nu, how'd that one work out? How did it work out? Vayomer Elokim Yehiyor. Vayehiyor. But Hashem says, Hu Amar Vayehi. He does what He says. Hashem says, I'll take care of you. Yeah, I don't know. I'm very nervous. Im amarti mataragli. If I said, I'm scared I'm going to slip. Hashem says, relax. Chastecha Hashem yisadeni. I got you. You know what the sign of a boteach b'Hashem is? What's a sign of bitachon? The Chovas HaLevavos, in his section. Now we're going back to the Rishonim. Okay, we're going back 1,000 years almost. The Chovas HaLevavo says, in his Shar HaBitachon, he says, you know what Bitachon is? You know what the sign of a Boteach Bashem is? Again, remember the distinction. Amuna means the abstract faith. Bitachon means being able to live it. Says the Chovas HaLevavo, a sign of Bitachon is Menuchas HaNefesh, Yishuv HaDas, peace of mind, staying calm, not panicking. That's a sign. That's a sign of true bitachon. That's a sign of leaning on Hashem a little bit, trusting your legs. Chanukah and Purim, trusting that Hashem, when it looks like things are getting a little too crazy, HaKadosh Baruch is going to work it out. Purim seemed a lot too crazy, but it worked out. What Esther did was crazy. What almost happened to the Jews was crazy, and somehow it worked out. Somehow the Jews got it together. Esther took a risk. She did the unfathomable, as we learned at the beginning of this year, and all of a sudden, things worked out. You know who doesn't trust? You know who doesn't rely? You know who always needs to be in control? It's Haman. That's Machshev. The Megillah calls Machsheves Haman, the thinking of Haman, the way that Haman operates. I'll tell you a very fascinating thing. There's a little volume called the Medrash Talmud, Medrash from Chazal. Right? Medrash Talmud is a collection of very unusual teachings from throughout the ages. You open up a Medrash Talpios, you always find something interesting, different and interesting. So in the Medrash Talpios, it tells us that in addition to Haman making his lottery, as described in the Megillah, Haman was a Baal Kishuf. He was involved in all sorts of black magic and all sorts of sorcery, and he was into all sorts of games of chance. Right? In addition to whatever he used for his lottery, he also rolled dice in order to determine the outcome of what was going to be, how successful he would be. And the Medrash Talpios says, Haman took 3 dice in his hand, and he rolled the dice. And he was looking for an omen, he was looking for a sign. And you know what he rolled? Anyone know what he rolled? He rolled 1, he rolled 3, and he rolled 3. And he was so excited. Gevaldik! It's a good sign, no? Why is it a good sign? Why is it a good sign? Because the king of Amalek, who Shaul HaMelech didn't kill, his name was Agag. Agag, Aleph, Gimel, Gimel. That's my guy. Aleph, 1, 3, 3. Aleph, Gimel, Gimel, Agag. This is a good sign, Amalek. And not only that, what's on the opposite side? And it's true about our dice. I don't know who made up dice. Apparently it goes back to Haman. What's on the other side of a 1, 3, 3? Yeah, 6 is on the other side of a 1. And the other side of a 3 is a 4. So what's 4, 6, 4? Dalid, Vav, Dalid. That's David. Oh, that's the Jewish Redeemer. Malka Mashicha. So this is great. Agag is on top, and David's on the bottom. This is great. This is a great sign for me. But you know what happened? Bitachon requires Menuchas HaNefesh. Menuchas HaNefesh and Bitachon, right, on a very basic level, means that when you leave your house and you lock the door, you don't have to go back to lock it 3 more times. Because you already locked it once. Haman spun a 1, 3, 3. He knows the other side is what? Haman was a big dice player. He knew it was on the other side. He knew on the other side is what? It's 4, 6, 4. Dalid, Vav, Dalid, David. But he just wanted to check, you know? Just want to make sure that I didn't make a mistake here. So he flipped over the dice. Just for a minute. Just for a moment. Just wanted to see what's on the other side, you know? He was anxious. It looks good, but I need to just double check. So he flips over the dice. Ah, look, see, on the back side of 1, 3, 3 is a 4, 6, 4, David. And then he got all excited. He went out to tell all of his, you know, all of his buddies, look, a good sign for all of us Amalekim. But he left David on top, and he left Agag on the bottom. Because he didn't have Menuchas HaNefesh, because he didn't trust. Right? Now, he wasn't a person of trust. But look how a person who, I just want to do a little bit more of my own hishtadlus, and he ruined everything. He ruined a good sign. Again, Hashem's still in charge. I don't know what that good sign would have produced had he left it alone. But he ruined everything by wanting to control it a little bit more. And therefore, Purim gives us an opportunity. Ad lo yada. It's a day where we say, Hashem emcha, you destroy Amalek today. Kol ha'osa malacha b'Purim, eino roa simin bracha le'olam. If Esther has to do a shtadlus, if Mordechai is forcing her to do a shtadlus, it has to be a shtadlus that makes literally no sense. That's the only type of a shtadlus that could bring about a Yeshua in the form of a Purim. There was a great tzaddik of Shlomo Karliner. Someone once came to him and they said, Rav Shlomo, how do you make a parnasa? How do you survive? So he says, what do you mean? He said in Yiddish, I have two keys. I have two cows. Key in Yiddish is cow. I have two cows. Oh, you have two cows, okay. So a short while later, this person came back one day and he said, Rav Shlomo, I would like to purchase some milk from you. So he said, milk? Why do you think I have milk? So you told me you have two keys. You told me you have two keys. So he says, you thought keys meant cows? No, no, no. What are my two keys? Now, as Jews, Baruch Hashem, we have a lot of keys. Right? Key in Yiddish means cow. But what are the keys? He said, my two keys are ki lishuascha kivinu kol hayom. And my other key is ki chastacha leneged einai. Pasuk in Teva. There was a tzaddik in Yerushalayim about 80 years ago. His name was Rav Shlomo Sobel. When Rav Shlomo Sobel was trying to marry off one of his daughters, he didn't have the financial means to do so. And someone came to him and said, listen, I want to make a shidduch with you, but I don't know how are you gonna support the couple. That was the practice. Still the practice in some places. What are you going to do? He says, don't worry, I have 26 keys. 26 cows you have? I never saw, you have a whole farm. I never knew you even had one cow. So he said, no. Kili olam chasto, kili olam chasto, kili. There's 26. In that parak of Tehillim, there's 26 keys. Kili olam chasto, Hashem will take care of it. Now, I happen to be the type of Jew who believes what I told you today, which is what? That there's a mitzvah of hishtadlus. Right? We're not supposed to sit back and wait for miracles. Maybe the biggest tzaddikim can live like this. I don't think this is a healthy way for the average person to live, and I want to say that out loud because a lot of people think that this is the right way to live. Okay, a person who's wealthy and can afford to, support someone and they want to do that willingly, that's great. If they happen to want to support you and that works for you, that's also great. Right? But don't expect that. That's not how Hashem runs the world. That's not the expectation, and that's not how Hashem expects things to go. Right? But to be able to say on some level when I am struggling and when I do need through a model, ki li olam chasto, ki li olam chasto, ki li olam chasto, Hashem, I can rely on you. There's a way you're going to work it out. There was a Breslover chassid from Poland, very successful person, he had a shoe factory. And this Breslover chassid, for whatever reason, he used to be the guy who got up to speak between Mincha and Maariv and Shul. His name was Rav Yitzchak Breiter, a tzaddik, a kadosh, a holy person, a very successful businessman, Breslover chassid. So he used to always speak between Mincha and Maariv, and very often the themes that he would speak about were Amuna, Bitachon, and Simcha. There was an old Yid who used to daven there. And every time he saw this Rav Yitzchak Breiter get up and speak about Amuna and Bitachon and Simcha, he would say, for him, Amuna, Bitachon, and Simcha. The guy's a rich guy. What does he know about Amuna, Bitachon, and Simcha? He was very successful. He has this big shoe factory in Poland. A rich person. What does he know about Amuna, Bitachon, and Simcha? One day, Rav Yitzchak Breiter's factory went up in flames. And that old Jew decided to come to Mincha that day to see if Rav Yitzchak Breiter would even show up. And he showed up. And he spoke between Mincha and Maariv. And you know what he spoke about? As his factory was burning to the ground? Amuna, Bitachon, and Simcha. And that old Jew went over to him and he said, I have to apologize to you. I always thought you were such a faker. It's easy for you, successful, happy, to talk about be happy, have faith in God, trust Hashem. Right? But now you're really living it. How do you do it? Your whole world just went up in flames. How do you do it? So he said, in Halacha, there's a discussion. Sometimes in davening we sit, sometimes in davening we stand. What's the halacha of a person is leaning? Is leaning considered in halacha sitting or standing? So Rav Yitzchak Breiter said, well, the halacha says, if the thing that you're leaning on, if the shtender that you're leaning on, if you're leaning on it in such a way that if it was pulled out from under you, you would collapse, right? Then that's called sitting. And if you're leaning on it in such a way that if someone were to remove the shtender, you would be able to remain standing, that's called standing. So he said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took away my shtender. He said, but I'm still standing. That's what he said. Hashem took away my parnasa, took away everything I have. But I'm still standing. You know why? Because I wasn't leaning on my parnasa as much as you thought I was. I'm leaning on Hashem. I'm leaning on Hashem. I'm able to still survive. I'm able to still function. The whole avoda of Chodesh Adar. Next week is Purim, in case we haven't realized yet. Next week is Purim, and the whole avoda of this month, we still have days left, is what? Is Adar. The Gemara says, in Maseches Beitza, that if you want to have success in this world, plant in your property an Adar tree, an Aleph Dalet Reish tree. It's Gemara in Maseches Beitza, an Eder tree. The way that the Tzaddikim explain it, what does it mean to plant an Eder tree in your property, in your backyard? in your nechassim, in your pursuits, in your financial pursuits, in your investments. Make sure you plant, it's a lucky tree. What is it? Plant an eider tree. It's spelled other. Aleph, Dalet, Reish. Plant an eider tree in your yard. What does it mean? The way that tzaddikim explain, the Mori Naim and other tzaddikim explain. Plant an eider tree means what? Aleph dar. Other. Aleph dar. How much is Aleph, the Alufo Shel Olam, the master of the world, are living in my backyard? How much is Hashem in my life? The more Hashem there, the more success I'll see. Again, we're not asked all around to rely entirely on Hashem. Hashtadlus is part of the curse of Adam Arishon. It's part of physical reality. And we're expected to play by those rules, and it's perfectly acceptable to play. At least, we're in Chodesh Adar, as we prepare for that Geula once again of Purim, leading us into the Geula of Pesach once again, we lean on HaKadosh Baruch Hu a little bit more. We're willing to take that risk. We're willing to jump off that cliff again with the confidence that it's not going to break us, but it's going to make us more whole. The Ponovitcher Rav was once dealing with a very, very weighty issue, a big machlokas. And he came to the Chafetz Chaim. And he asked the Chafetz Chaim, what should I do? Which opinion should I follow? I mean, I want to support this side. The Chafetz Chaim said, you should follow the side that's stronger. So the Ponovitcher Rav said, the side that's stronger is anti-Torah. The side that has more people and is more vocal, the side that's stronger is anti-Torah. So the Chafetz Chaim said to the Ponovitcher Rav, that's not what I meant. I said, follow who's stronger. Hashem is stronger. Hashem is always stronger. Hashem's side will always win. It may not be the popular opinion. It might be hard to understand how it's going to work out. This is going to break me. It's not going to break you. The Baal Shem Tov taught, and it encompasses everything that he wanted to teach, that if you can just lean on Hashem a little bit more, it's not going to break you. All those broken pieces at the bottom of that valley in the Skolya Rebbe's dream were whole pieces, were complete pieces of the Baal Shem Tov. So I'll just end with one final teaching from the Eish Kodesh, Piazetz Rebbe. The Eish Kodesh in his writings on Purim, which is unfathomable, writing in the 1940s, the early 1940s, sitting in a ghetto, trying to mechazek Jews to be happy on Purim. What do you tell a Jew like that on Purim? He said a couple of amazing things. I'll just tell you one of them. The Eish Kodesh said, we know that the Tikkunei Zohar says that Purim is like Yom Kippur. Purim is like Yom Kippur. How is Purim like Yom Kippur? He said a few insights that day, but I'll just share, again, the one that's relevant to us right now. With this, we'll conclude. How is Purim like Yom Kippur? The Gemara says that on some level, you know how Yom Kippur works? All you have to really do for Yom Kippur to work is you have to show up. The Gemara uses the phrase, Itzumo shel yom mechaper. Itzumo shel yom. The essence of the day is mechaper. There is an opinion that says you have to do tshuva. We actually paskin like that opinion. But any opinion, any authentic opinion in the Gemara also has some truth to it. So there is an opinion that on Yom Kippur, you don't even have to do tshuva. You just have to literally be in Yom Kippur. You have to exist in the world. You have to maybe just know it's Yom Kippur. You don't even have to go to shul. You have to just be aware of Yom Kippur. Maybe not actively violate Yom Kippur. Just exist within that world, that holy space called Yom Kippur. So said the Piazetz Rebbe to Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, it's kind of hard for you to feel Purim, I imagine. But he said to them, you know what you need to do to make Purim work? Nothing. Purim's like Yom Kippur. Just exist. It's a day of bitul hishtadlus. Ad lo yada. You don't have to make it work. You just have to trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has the means to make it work. So I give us a bracha as we come to the Yom Tov of Purim. Adar, Aleph Dar, plant that Adar in your life. Let Hashem be a little bit more. Trust Hashem a little more. Imamarti mataragli. If I thought my feet are going to slip, says David Melech, it's not true. Kili olam chasto, kili olam chasto. There's always something more to rely on. Remember, like Rav Huttner said, this is the day where we let go of the reins and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu take charge. So Mirat Hashem, we should learn from the strength of Esther and Mordechai. And we should learn from, again, the lesson of Chodesh Adar, to rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to lean in a little bit more, to be prepared to take that risk and to jump, and know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there to catch each and every one of us. Have a Freilichin Chodesh Adar, an amazing prayer.